We went on the road for this episode of Double E's Talk Tech and met up with some power experts to talk about the whole gamut of the world of power. That's systems that measure femtoamps, which is a billionth of a millionth of an amp, all the way up to systems that can supply 100 kilowatts of power. I hope it's as fun for you as it was for me. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to Double E's Talk Tech. My name is Daniel Bogdanoff, and I'm joined here by Chris Kane, and we're in New Jersey, so you can tell we're not, if you're watching, you can tell we're not in our normal Colorado Springs site. We're in a room here in New Jersey surrounded by loads of power equipment, no pun intended.
or pun intended.
Or pun intended. Yeah, we'll go with, yes, I definitely meant to say that. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and what you're doing now?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. So I'm an executive. I actually manage the team that does our electronic industrial products, as you said, spread all over the world. I've got teams throughout Asia, throughout the Americas, and some folks in Europe as well. And they do a wide variety of products, including all of these wonderful power products that we have displayed here in front of us, DMMs, function generators, DAQs, all of our board test, electronic board test products, things like precision SMUs, device analyzers, and even things like actually this device current analyzer, which actually comes out of my team in Hachioji, Japan.
Yeah. So the device current analyzer, for those of you listening, it kind of looks like, if you know what an Infinium scope looks like, where it has like a multiplex control knob and a couple buttons on the front end and a big screen. And it has some big old connectors up front.
Yes.
Which I assume are for like pods of some type.
Very specialized interface pods. So yeah, it looks like a digital oscilloscope. It's not turned on here. And that's essentially the heart of it. But what's very different about it with these special pods that go into here and come out, we can actually do precision current measurements at 2 giga sample rates, but down to the femtoampere level.
Femtoamps.
Femtoamperes.
Okay.
And over a huge dynamic range, okay? So this is essentially up to about 18 or 20-bit digitizer.
Holy moly.
And so that's what's very different about it. So when you want to look at let's sample, you have an IoT circuit where it actually has a battery life that's years long.
Right.
And the RF section that communicates to the outside world turns on and off. Well, you want to be able to characterize the maybe micro or even nanowatts of power usage in those short little time frames. So imagine the kind of current and power, the short
right.
duration. You can see this with full resolution, both on the voltage axis and over that very short
okay.
time cycle.
So you can basically get really precise with your low current sleep state type measurements, but
yes.
then when all your stuff wakes up and turns on, it's not going to like blow your inputs.
Which is exactly, and
yeah.
it's many decades, and you want to be able to have that entire range within view almost instantaneously. So that it's been designed for that circumstance. So modern IoT devices, you know, imagine healthcare products, especially ones that are implanted in people.
Yeah.
You've got to have a very careful power budget.
You don't want to go in and
yeah,
repair
the
that
battery
one,
replacement
right?
hurts.
Yeah. Oof, that would not be good. So you've been around for, you know, like you said, over almost 35 years and counting now.
Yes, yeah.
At HP Agilent Keysight. I don't know if you said that, but I knew that. Anyway, because we also, you know, this weekend was the IoT challenge in New York, which was fun. What's the most spectacular equipment failure you've seen in your time?
Most spectacular equipment failure.
Yeah.
Hold on. Stop the tape. Since we're on the topic of the giraffe epidemic, we have a great new ebook out just for listeners of this podcast. We're even recording this intro before the episode itself, so I'm hoping to work in the topic of a giraffe epidemic at some point in the conversation, and then we can use this clip. Otherwise, it would make absolutely no sense. Anyways, the team put together an awesome new ebook called Tech Trends, which explores how to prep for technologies like DDR5, C6, PCIe 3.0, 4.0, 5.0, Thunderbolt, PAM4, and more. Go to doubleeastalktech.com and download it now. It's free. Check it out.
Oh, the most spectacular equipment failure.
Yeah.
I think one of my favorite memories was when I had a team and they were designing a new backplane for a large system. And it was a big DC backplane, and they had a huge amount of very large bypass caps, very physically large, bigger than this microphone that's on the desk. Several of those in this assembly, and what we found out later, as it was powered up for a few minutes, and they were making some measurements and checking it out, just first power up on the first build, somebody heard a funny noise. Hissing noise.
Oh, that's not good.
and notice that some goop was leaking out of one of the electrolytics.
And these are like soda can size, bigger.
They're good size.
Yeah.
I'd say dangerously sized.
Okay.
Because if anybody in your audience is familiar with large electrolytic, they actually have usually a scribe pattern, a cutout pattern. It's a vent.
Okay.
If you power them, if you invert the polarity of those, they will explode.
Right. Bad.
and that's what was starting to occur.
Oh, no.
Fortunately, one of the senior engineers knew what that sound was and scrambled and essentially yanked the power off the whole bench.
Oh, my goodness.
And then evacuated everybody from the area.
Yeah.
And we left. And fortunately, nothing actually really exploded, but it was because we came back and several of them had bulged appreciably and almost blew the stack out. So that's kind of exciting. And it was a new engineer. Guy had just started a couple months, and it was his first design. He was a little bit chagrined that 75% of his capacitors were oriented the wrong way.
Ooh. Yeah. I feel like if you have a less experienced person working on that, you might want to double check those.
you might want to,
There's a good lesson
there. Maybe
even
triple check.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That would be exciting to see some big ones go off.
It is. I've actually seen it done on purpose in an explosive chamber.
Okay.
I've actually been to vendors that actually make those components. And, of course, they have to test them
for
that behavior.
So cool.
And then there's stories, too, just to finish it out. You actually have to make sure that as you load those on a board that you have – in fact, you'll find it on some PC boards. You'll find a big hole at where the capacitor's loaded.
Oh.
That's a vent hole.
Okay. So
otherwise, it'll
blow
the part off the board and
send
shrapnel about. So,
oh, my goodness.
It's exciting.
That, yeah. That, good answer. Yeah, that's one of the things like repair guys are always looking for, or repair folks when they're, especially vintage equipment.
Yes.
So you buy an old analog scope, and the first thing a lot of people do is they'll either go through and recap all the electrolytics, or they'll go and find the bulgy ones and, just because they start to age out, too.
They age out.
They won't be backwards, but they'll...
Yeah, and there's certain other ones, some tantalums and batches and whatnot can have failures as well. Those are more like popcorn, but...
And one of those go out in an old gear. You just never quite know what else it will take with it if it...
Well, that's true, physically. And then you're just left with the two leads.
It's like, what value is that? I don't know. Charcoal?
Even a semiconductor. I've even seen on a semiconductor surface mount part, there's just the two leads left.
Yeah.
The package is gone.
Like a shot from a microscope. Every once in a while on Twitter or something, I'll see someone post a picture of something like that. Like, does anybody have this thing? I'm trying to figure out what this resistor was. And it's just... Like, sorry, that's a 50-year-old thing. Like, there's no way. There's no coming back from that. So speaking of high power, I've used like triple output power supplies, and we have the little guy over there.
Yep.
I love that little thing. Mm-hmm. But I don't have much experience with like the capital P power sort of instruments. So. Can you talk? So this is a couple thousand volts. It's a lot.
This particular one actually goes up to just shy of 1,000 volts.
Okay.
And then there's a version that goes just shy of 800 amperes at lower voltage. And they come in 5 and 10 kilowatt in the same package versions.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And then you can stack them up.
Oh.
And so they're actually designed specifically to emulate. Technically, it's a 2-quadrant power supply, so it can source and seek current.
Okay.
Okay.
So a normal supply, I'm going to break this down. So a normal supply is just an output, right? And you don't want to inject much into the front end or else it
won't sink current. That's the function of a load. And a programmable version of that, which I think is probably this unit, is called an E-load, electronic load, where it's going to pull current. And then whether it goes plus and minus voltage, that's the other quadrant, essentially.
Okay. Yeah. So you have four quadrants, which is...
Voltage and current.
So you have voltage and current. So quadrant one would be source voltage, source current. And then, like, generally you only are doing... Are there three or four? So a 2-quadrant would source current and voltage.
a two quadrant, in this case, it actually sources and sinks current,
okay,
but it's above 0 volts.
Okay, that makes sense. Oh, yeah, I guess you don't sink voltage, right?
Well, you source and sink current.
Yeah.
Okay, and the voltage potential can either be positive or negative.
Okay.
With the reference you're referencing. So we have power supplies that can swing from a positive to a negative reference that are, and that's direct current. Then we also make AC power supplies, sinusoidal power supplies.
That makes sense. So what are people doing with a 10 kilowatt power supply?
Well, they'll stack them up, and you might stack 8 or 10.
So what are people doing with an 80 kilowatt power supply?
Or a 100 kilowatt power supply set in a rack? Well, that's actually a programmable battery then. It can emulate like a battery set in an electric automobile.
Okay.
And so if you're testing the charging or inverter systems, there's an inverter system in every electric automobile because the motor generator is an AC, okay? So you got to convert the DC from the battery to AC to run the motor to drive the vehicle forward.
That makes sense.
And then when you do regenerative braking in an electric vehicle, then the motor is being spun by the wheels and generating voltage and current. That's then rectified and put it, and it charges the battery. So you're both in a battery, charging it. You're sourcing the current into the battery, and when you're discharging the battery, sinking the current in the battery. When you're sourcing it, you're discharging the battery. So in essence, this then becomes a programmable battery, and then you need to be able to seamlessly go from sink to source,
right? To emulate a battery. I never really thought, I understood regenerative braking was a thing, but I never thought through the mechanics of it. So essentially your motor is turning into a turbine.
A generator.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And then essentially generating power.
Right.
And then that power is actually used to recharge the battery as you de-accelerate the vehicle.
That makes sense. I don't know why I never thought through the mechanics of it, but.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, of course. Motors, you spin them wrong and they'll mess up your circuitry. So you have to.
And it's important in an electric vehicle because you want to extract every joule of possible energy, both what's stored in the battery and what you can reclaim from momentum and gravity.
Right. And then you get that, break 300 miles on your car, hopefully.
Exactly. And this power supply is also regenerative as well.
Okay.
So
it's a regenerative power supply. So when you break the power supply,
you turn it into a load, it's sinking current.
Okay.
Okay. Traditionally, loads have converted the electrical energy into heat.
Right. That makes sense.
It's a function of a resistor.
Like a resistor. Yeah.
Exactly. So an E-load is a programmable resistive unit.
Sure.
Okay. It does more than that, but that's the heart of its function. What this does is this rectifies that DC voltage and turns it back into AC and puts it back on the mains of the unit.
Fascinating. Okay.
Which is very efficient.
So basically, instead of it being powered from the mains, it's essentially repowering itself?
It's actually just putting the energy back into the AC mains.
Okay, like into the grid.
Yes.
Okay.
And that's called for because if I'm in a giant gigafactory or in an automotive assembly factory and testing these inverters and charging systems for an electric vehicle, I don't want to dump all of the energy into the atmosphere, into the factory.
Yeah.
Because then I have to have huge aircon units to extract it out to keep people and equipment from melting.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so what we do is we actually then regenerate that back into the AC mains. It just gets consumed by whatever else is plugged into the AC.
Okay.
But we do it at a very high efficiency.
Okay.
So the total overall cost, you have to remember actually in a modern factory, most of your cost, well, actually it's like a data center. You know this.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot.
The cost of a data center is in the AC. Not the electronic equipment, not the computers.
Right. It's the heat and and that's why they do them up north where power is cheap and air is cheap. So you can almost, instead of running like a compressor unit to get cool air, you can run natural Nordic air into your data center and it cools it down.
Exactly. And if you're talking about generating at times a peak load of 100 kilowatts or 80 kilowatts of heat.
Oh, man. So take, what's that, like 1,000 100 watt light bulbs or something and times 10. So
it's a lot of heat. Yeah, so if you can convert the majority of that back into useful electrical energy as a total package, that's a very useful thing on an industrial level. So this is a kind of a precision programmable power supply and load, but essentially what it does is it emulates a battery.
Okay.
Programmable battery. So it allows testing of the electronics that's connected to the battery that's going to be charging and discharging the battery in its end use.
Okay.
Okay.
And that makes sense. Like for an electric vehicle, you have, you know, the driver and the motor and the that whole side, and then you have the battery side of it, and you want to be able to test those independently of each other.
Correct.
You don't want to like, well, I hope my batteries work. Let's plug it into my motor.
Right. Reverse. Well, that'll run it one way, but then you need to charge when it's charging, either charging from the outside plug-in from the vehicle.
Yeah.
Or it's being charged from the regenerative function on the motor generator of the vehicle itself.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So are there other things that people are doing with... I'm going to call them big honking power supplies.
So other things is we use a version of this. Actually, if you look at photovoltaic systems, there again, you need to convert the DC energy that's coming off the photovoltaic cells that are exposed to sunlight and convert that to useful AC power for local consumption. So there's inverters in that system as well.
Sure.
And a lot of them because there's a lot of solar photovoltaic systems. So again, we use these big power supplies to test those large inverters.
Okay, that makes sense.
Even extraterrestrial.
Oh, so space.
Satellites.
Okay.
Are frequently mostly solar powered. A few are nuclear powered.
Yeah.
But mostly solar powered.
They're nuclear powered satellites?
Oh, yes.
Oh. Are they government only, I assume?
I would hope so.
That we know of.
Well,
there's the whole like X-37B space plane that just kind of... people, you know, amateur astronomers are like, oh, we found it. And you kind of track where it was in orbit, but no one really.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, the cost and complexity of a nuclear powered system, you have to justify the application. Like a lot of the satellites that have gone into deep space are they essentially have a nuclear powered battery.
Okay.
A warmth source. I mean, it's not turning it to steam, but it's turning in high enough heat that then there's a converter that generates electricity that runs a satellite as it passes by Pluto.
Yeah, that makes sense. I never thought about. I always assumed it was solar, but by the time you're out past Pluto, you don't really have
not much sun left. Yeah,
it looks like a star.
Yeah,
and then I just always assumed like it got up to momentum and just kind of twiddle your thumbs and wait till it.
All the electronics, it's RF system to transmit back and to receive instructions.
That makes sense.
It's got to be powered. So a lot of those have a little. Nuclear cell that actually provides the power.
Fascinating.
Pretty refined design.
I had no idea. Okay.
Yeah.
And I guess they're obviously not doing like fission or anything. It's just...
Not that I know of.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So you could have like a nuclear powered car. I don't know. That seems like a bad idea.
Yeah.
No fender benders allowed.
That's the trick.
And that's more of a trickle charge, I imagine, on a nuclear system, like in a satellite. It's not a... Like a car, you want a lot of power at once.
Yeah, a modern vehicle, electrical vehicle needs, you know, probably 20, 30, 40, 100 kilowatts to make it useful to go over long ranges. An extraterrestrial system like that, if I remember right, I'm not an expert, but they're usually in the hundreds of watts or maybe low kilowatts kind of range.
Okay.
Because you also, it's very expensive weight wise. And then how do you get that in orbit or into its intended destination? So you have all these trade offs.
How do you actually deploy
Space designs are wonderful. Yeah. But again, that's an application. We sell a lot of our power products into aerospace and defense because they need that precision, that low noise capability.
That makes sense.
To refine their designs, to make sure they work. Because the repair, they either have to work once. It's very important.
Yeah.
Or when they work, they have to work, or they have to work in an environment where they cannot be repaired.
That makes sense. And you mentioned noise. So, you know, it's one thing to generate 80 or 100 kilowatts of power. It's another thing to do it in a usable fashion.
Correct.
Are there tolerances that you see or what
it's what part of all that? Of our specifications. There's Ripple, there's other forms of noise specifications we have in all of our power supplies. And it's one of the things that Keysight has always focuses on, because when you use an instrument grade power supply like these, programmable power supply, as opposed to like the switching power supply in a PC, you know, the power brick. Those are perfectly adequate to power a PC, which is a digital appliance with a little bit of audio, okay? But otherwise, they're not ultra low noise environment.
Well, if you've ever like plugged one into a scope, like a switch mode power supply, just
it's ugly,
and it does it just it leaves its mark on the whole system.
But they're inexpensive.
Yes, they are.
There's a trade-off there, and that's part of the trade-off we make. We're trying to make our products, you know, cost competitive, of course. But the other thing is we want to have low noise because when these are used by design engineers,
sure,
and so we want them to focus on the outcome of their design. So we want to minimize our noise contribution to that. And that's especially critical when it when you talk about power and the power supply to the unit itself.
That makes sense.
Yeah. In fact, actually, the unit right in front of you, that's a power supply analyzer, kind of like this, but a different scale of operation.
Yeah.
And that has very low noise specs because, again, you want to be able to observe what noise is coming through your design, not what's coming through the power supply or the test instrumentation itself.
I remember the first time I saw a power analyzer and like realized how much more to power there was. And I did some power stuff in college, like, you know, motors and systems and all that. But then to actually see it in practice and realize like it's not just current and voltage and time.
No, like it's not just a rectifier and a transformer and some caps to smooth it out.
Yeah.
It's way, way beyond that. They're very complex dynamic systems. Multi-stage because we actually can manipulate between AC and there's advantages and DC. Okay, not only do we output AC and DC, sure, but we're rectifying and inverting and, as I said, the regenerative portion. And then I actually be able to control that and also be able to have a fast response time. See, we want to be able to maybe in some cases respond in nanoseconds or microseconds to an on
that
off.
That makes sense because of the load switches.
Voltage.
And this is something that like you see on boards when processor goes to hold a bunch of ones or releases them to zeros, then you see the power rail ripple. And I think we've talked about
and we want to be able to recreate analysis. That for the design engineer to qualify their design. So yeah. And then we have, you know, all kinds of modes. Even our you know, wonderful bench power supplies like these in front of you. Not sure about this one. This one may be not have that advanced features, but I mean, there's, you know, constant voltage. You set it to a voltage and it stays mm-hmm. there, or constant current where it holds the current and the voltage change, but we have constant power in other modes as well.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah, I don't think the little one does it. I know the big one, bigger.
I think so, yeah.
Ones I've played with. Yeah, I'm wanting to dig into these more because there's so much fun stuff you could.
There's a lot in there. I mean, if you ever take one apart, there it's the whole plethora.
Yeah.
I mean,
can you talk about the giant transformer in the middle of the
Oh, like in these units?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a toroidal transformer.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Like the first
multi-tap.
Time I saw it, like hang it up from my car review mirror or something.
Instead of
dice. Like,
yeah, it's amazing. You know, the engineers on my team that work on that, actually they spend months and months and months in the simulation world.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that makes sense.
We actually use specialized simulation software that simulates the environment. I mean, you know, transformers, heavy inductance, but also the interplay of materials in a transformer.
Interesting.
Okay. Or you can actually put bias currents into a transformer and modify their behavior that way as well.
It gets so you can almost tune it, like have control circuitry to tune your transformer and then.
And they are. And they're dynamically controlled.
Fascinating.
So there's actually, some of the biggest development areas, you know, obviously there's the firmware that's running the instrument, communicating through the back here, the communication ports, the display, but there's also a tremendous amount of FPGA, hardware software design, that's in this dynamic control system that's making this thing stable, making it perform in all the different modes.
Are you seeing that in other industries too, like that type of technology, or is it more of a – so where else do you see that kind of
Well, activity? You certainly see it in things like precision source measurement units, which in essence is a power supply with a symmetrical digitizer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Makes sense.
And actually, to be honest, all of these power supplies in a way are SMUs. They have that built in.
Yeah, they
measure themselves.
Yeah.
They have a readback, a current readback. Maybe this one – actually, it might.
I'm pretty sure it does.
Because there's protection modes, and that's a form of that feedback. And some of these have very, very, you know, this one has medium size. Actually, for the class of power supply, it has some really stellar current reading capability. okay, to monitor itself. And this is world class.
The analyzer,
Yeah, the analyzer. And so they all do. So they definitely share some technologies. We actually have, you know, I have different teams. The team in Bud Lake here actually is the team that has designed a number of these power supplies. But I have other teams in other locales, like in Japan. They focus on things like SMUs or precision current measurement. Mm-hmm. Precision current measurement is not quite the same thing as just measuring a voltage.
Interesting.
Tell me about that. Where's the current go?
Right. That makes sense. It seems like you would want to tap off, if I were just to guess, you'd try and tap off a little bit of it and then extrapolate.
Yes, and you have to take into account there's all kinds. So actually in SMUs, they typically use a triax because there's the current flow between a positive and negative terminal, but you have to have a sense and you have to monitor the voltage and current on that sense point as well.
Oh, man. Okay.
Because there's all kinds of effects that you want to discount out or compensate for to make sure that at the point of application, that's the current or that's the current flowing through.
Right. So like if you have line losses in your main feeds, you can also hook up sense wires that essentially you tell the supply, make the voltage at the end of these sense wires the voltage. So it'll, you know, essentially bump up your power a little bit to account for the loss.
Right.
And then the smaller sense wires you can shield and they're not going to have nearly as much loss as like a big old something to actually get the bulk of the power out.
Exactly. So there's the, you know, voltmeters have, you know, four wire sets.
Right.
Okay. Two wires for measurement and then an additional two wires for sense. Some of the more advanced schemes have five and six wires.
Really?
Yeah. For guarding and whatnot.
Interesting.
Because you have to guard and know where the current's actually flowing through. Is it flowing through the circuit you're trying to measure or the impedance point, or is it flowing through around things, or is it flowing through your sensing circuits? Huh. So you need to be able to guard that out. I'm probably oversimplifying it. I need to have my technologists here to better explain it to the audience, but there's a lot of papers on Keysight.com that go into great detail. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah.
But that's great. Coming back to power, we take it for granted, you know, we assume everything is just like in our schematics. It's this mythical voltage current source. Okay.
Right.
The problem is it never has those ideal characteristics. You know, it's never as accurate or as steady, and it has impulse responses, and it has a characteristic impedance that doesn't go to infinite current in zero time.
Right. It's like a 200 watt power supply is not going to do like 200 amps at 1 volt. Like it's just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's those guardian. That's it. That's kind of a gotcha. If you're like picking one out, you got to make sure you're keeping an eye on that.
And it is.
I don't want to dig too deep into supply stuff, but there's some really cool like auto ranging things that can do. And
yeah.
But that's probably a video for our Keysight Labs YouTube channel and not the podcast. I think we're planning on that one actually. We're rocking up a script for it.
So awesome. That'd be perfect.
Yeah.
I'd be happy to have some folks help out with that.
Sounds good. Well, they're all here, so I'll bug them later. Chris said that I get you full time. No, I'm just kidding.
Works for me.
Cool. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Daniel.
You mentioned that you have teams all across the globe.
Yeah.
I'd love to record a little, maybe a bonus segment or another little ditty on that. But that is it for this episode of Double E's Talk Tech. Thanks for tuning in. And Chris Kane, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Daniel.
It's been a great conversation.
Yeah.
Make sure to subscribe to Double E's Talk Tech in your favorite podcast engine. We're kind of everywhere. But also make sure to review it because that's how we get found. And if I'm going to make a commitment here and we'll see what happens. If you review it and send me a screenshot to my Twitter page or one of the Facebook things, I might send you some swag just for getting that review in. So
awesome.
So go review, please, if you like it. If not, you don't have to. That's fine. But let me know if you don't like it, and we'll try and make it better for you. So that's it. Thanks for watching. I'm Daniel Bogdanoff, joined by Chris Kane.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next time.